Good morning, everyone. Glad to see you here. I just want to start off today. Let's make sure we get our computers right. By reminding you that last spring we had a hearing where we got numbers from the Pollution Control Agency talking about the health care costs of fine particulate matter and ozone. Those numbers were absolutely astronomical. And so as a chair, I was sitting here thinking, something is not right here. We are the ones that are tasked with dealing with air pollution, but don't have much incentive because we're not paying the costs. The costs are being paid for by our health committees. And so we need to have a new, we've been operating in silos, and I think we have to have a new way of operating. So I talked to Chair Liebling about inviting some of the folks from her committee here, and I am so glad she is here to hear from the physicians who will start us off, from the PCA who will follow up with reminding us of some of those huge numbers and what they mean for both our constituents who pay insurance and our taxpayers, as well as just the health impacts. So welcome. Welcome, Representative Mueller, to the committee. So with that, we will start with Paul Kubik, and welcome you to the committee. Thank you for coming.
And thank you, Madam Chairman, for having all of us here today. I am a lung specialist from the Children's Hospitals, and I'm going to address some of the issues that involve air quality and children's lung health. My credentials are that I am a specialist boarded in pediatric lung disease. There are about 1,000 of us in the United States. There are not very many. I practice at the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as Gillette and Regions. And also, some of my partners are attending physicians at the University of Minnesota. There's a personal aspect to pulmonary health with myself. I am an asthmatic. I have been since the 1940s, and I can address some issues that concern air quality and pulmonary health for myself. We're a large group. We have 30 physicians in the group, and 11 of us deal with chronic lung disease in children, including asthma, lung disease of premature infants, and a number of other inherited diseases. You know, 10% of Minnesota children are asthmatic. If you look at the African American population, it's over 15%. And some of the Caribbean Islanders, the prevalence is over 20%. If you look at asthma and the other chronic lung illnesses of children in Minnesota, you're looking at approximately 30% of the population. And I mention this because they are the children who are most susceptible to the effects of our air and air quality. Well, all of us breathe in air so we can allow oxygen to diffuse into our bloodstream and eliminate CO2, breathing in and out. But as we breathe in and out, we breathe in every particulate imaginable in the air. And those that are really important to us in pulmonary medicine are not just pollutants, but the particles of pollens and molds, the diesel exhaust particles that are very tiny, chemicals and gases such as ozone. So there's an array of particulates that we breathe in. And if you look up and back of us or to the side, you'll see a picture of a stylized picture of our lungs. And in the middle there's our windpipe, and the windpipe divides many, many times until it gets to the air sacs of the lungs, the alveoli. And when we're talking about particles that are inhaled, where they end up in your lungs depends on their size. With large particles being deposited in the biggest airways, this is a stylized look at how particles deposit along the air tubes, and the very tiniest particles actually can move all the way to the air sacs of the lungs. And if you look at this little airway tree, the air sacs are at the terminal end. It's about 15 to 20 divisions of the airways by the time they get to the air sacs. The particles that we breathe in the air, especially particles under 3 or 4 microns in diameter, can actually be inhaled all the way to the air sacs of the lungs. Wherever particles deposit, chemical reactions can occur, including irritation to tissue, inflammation, and in the air tubes of the lungs, a degree of irritation that will even cause closure or blockage of those airways, particularly in patients who have underlying problems such as asthma. And this is a very busy slide. I don't know if you could see it on your handout, but it shows the particle size and where they deposit along the air tubes. Large particles larger than 5 or 10 microns, a micron is a millionth of a meter, it's not very big, but actually particles that size move all the way down the air tube to the air sacs of the lungs. When we measure air quality, the concentration of particles that are about 2 to 3 microns in diameter. And people ask, do those particles really reach my tiny air tubes and my lung? And the answer is they do. And a good example of that is how many of you have used an asthma inhaler and seen the puff of particulate that comes out of an inhaler? The size of those particles that we use to treat asthma, and I use to treat my asthma, those particle sizes are exactly 2.5 microns in diameter. So we actually, in clinical medicine, use particulates to deposit important and helpful chemicals in our airway. Unfortunately, the ones we're talking about today are potentially injurious. And it isn't just the particles of diesel exhaust and the particles of carbon from combustion, but also small pollen grains, a mold, and then chemicals, again, that can irritate the airway, like ozone. It's not that these particles cause asthma or cause cystic fibrosis, but they contribute to the injury and the inflammation that we see in the airways of these patients. And it's the cumulative effect of everything that we inhale that leads to the tissue injury that we see in pulmonary disease. So again, pollution doesn't cause asthma, but it contributes to its management and it complicates management. A great example would be our asthmatic athletes in the late summer and fall of the year. These patients we see frequently. They are in two-a-day football practice starting in mid-August, or they're cross-country runners beginning their practice session in August and September. They're allergic. The pollen counts are high, especially ragweed, and mold a little later. It's hot. Heat alone can trigger asthmatic symptoms, and air quality changes in late August and early September. We have some cool days where it's easy to practice and our young people don't need their medications as much. And then a warm front moves in, trapping the cooler air near the surface, right by the playing fields, and the particulate levels rise and we see an increase in symptoms in our athletes, and a need for more medication, a more likelihood of exercise-induced asthma, And actually, we see more hospital admissions during the late August through early October time period than any other time period of the year. And it's a combination of many particulates and increased injury to the airways in our cross-country runners, our football players. What we do see is an improved ability for our athletes to participate compared to when I started in this field. I never had a college athlete with asthma and allergies playing at a Division I level. Today in clinic, we have at least 25 or 30. The medicines are definitely better. We treat acute problems on the athletic field better. However, the young people still have significant problems. We also see this in the winter with our cross-country skiers. And one day of hospitalization for asthma in August and September, the first day of admission is at least $6,000 to $7,000. An emergency room visit for asthma at our hospitals averages between $3,000 to $4,000 for a single emergency room visit. We haven't changed our admission rate for asthma at the children's hospitals in the last 10 years, and the length of stay hasn't changed, especially during this period of August to early October, which is a time of high pollution and high allergens. So it's this combination of effects that leads to the problems we see. To address this issue, we also have to consider the indoor environment. Cigarette smoke still in about 20 to 25% of the homes in Minnesota, and many of our asthmatic children are still exposed in the home to particulates, and in the winter to wood stove smoke. It's a combination of all these factors that have resulted in no decrease in asthma and chronic lung disease in children over the last 10 to 15 years. I'm not going to quote any further statistics. I will be open to questions. Thank you.
Let me start with the question. You were saying the first day of hospitalization and the cost of that. What would be the range of stay?
Well,
one day?
Four? Yeah. Our length of stay in Minnesota right now for an asthmatic under 18 years of age is between 2 and 3 days. We basically haven't changed that length of stay in the last decade. That is for a child who's on our medical surgical service with an IV and breathing treatments. It doesn't include patients who go to our intensive care units where the care is much more costly. If you're an asthmatic and you end up on our intensive care unit, you will probably be there from 7 to 10 days. And the cost, sadly, especially if you need support for breathing, can be 3 to 4 times that a day of a typical hospital admission. And our, by the way, our intensive care unit for pulmonary disease at both the children's is almost always full.
It's almost always full?
Yes.
Yeah. Has that been a constant pattern then for the past decade?
That's been a pretty constant pattern, and probably most of you know that there are only a certain number of approved critical beds for children in the Twin Cities area. And for small children, there are only a very few units. So that number really hasn't changed much recently. And by the way, the cost of medications is extreme. If you are to buy some of the asthma inhalers over the counter, even with insurance and copays, an inhaler may cost you $110 to $160. That's with insurance, without $300 to $400 for some of the inhalers that will last you a month. And if your asthma is under poor control, you're going to go through 2 or 3 inhalers a month. So very, very costly. disease and the most prevalent chronic disease of childhood.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And thank you, Doctor. My question has to do with once a person has ingested some of these bad things, they get way down into the deep part of their lungs. Is the effect cumulative each time, or do the lungs have any method of cleansing themselves as time goes on?
They do. The lungs have a defense system for removing both little particles and fighting the inflammation that pollen grains and diesel exhaust particles may initiate. So we have a defense system. Interestingly, that defense system is immature in most individuals up to 7 or 8 or 10 years of age. And because of genetic variation, some people protect their airways with these defense systems better than others. But you can be assured small children have a limited defense system.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Well, when I was younger and foolish, I was in a silo on a farm and ingested a lot of mold or whatever and got extremely sick. And the doctor said it was something called farmer's lung and that I'd have some permanent damage. Or how would that relate to what you talked about now?
We don't see a lot of farmer's lung in young people. That's a term used for a disease that's predominantly in the air sacs of the lungs, and it's not a true allergy as we would think of it with pollen or mold, but it's an inflammatory injury that goes on and on even after you've no longer had exposure. And again, there's probably some genetic space to it too. It's related to bird fanciers disease, diseases that you can get from some poultry too, and it can be very serious.
Representative Kahn.
Sorry that I came late, but has anyone talked about the economic distribution of children with asthma? The economic status of children with asthma.
Yes, I can address that. In fact, that's a really excellent point. The majority of our hospitalizations for asthma in the Twin Cities area are young people that live in the inner city. They also are more likely to live in areas of high traffic, pollution, and freeways. By the way, a lot of our football fields, as you run along 94, are quite close to the freeway. The burden of asthma in lower social and economic groups is much higher than in urban and more affluent areas. There's no question about it. And so there's a disproportionate share of asthma in our children in the inner city. Does anybody know where the most polluted intersection is in the Twin Cities? Anybody take a guess? Very well known.
University.
What? You said university?
No.
She is correct. Snelling and University. And it's just interesting that young people with lower socioeconomic status have a greater burden.
This is probably not a fair question, but to follow up on Representative Kahn, do you know anything about the numbers of school absenteeism and how?
I don't know the exact numbers, but asthma to date is the number one cause for school absenteeism in the Twin Cities area, the number one medical reason.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. It's really interesting. And just to kind of close the loop on the question that Representative Kahn is asking, is it, you know, when we talk about the burden being heaviest on the lowest socioeconomic group, is that possibly because of the relationship to air pollution in the places they live, or is that something that we're just speculating about?
It's multifactorial. There's absolutely no question about that. And there are many social aspects to that and economic aspects. But when you look at prevalence and incidence of asthma and acute asthma in large metro areas, there's quite an association to highly trafficked areas and freeways, especially within 500 meters of freeways. So there's definitely there's a temporal and a spatial relationship to the built environment. There's absolutely no question about that. But that's entwined with families that are often in chaos. These young people fail their regular scheduled appointments, and they often have poor access to the medications that they need. And even if those medications are partially paid for, they don't necessarily fill their prescriptions. So that's a very it's a very complicated process.
Madam Chair, thanks. Madam Chair, and I assume, too, that because smoking is more prevalent in lower-income folks, that that might be a contributing factor as well. You're talking about the indoor environment?
Yes, it is. And just the fact that the only place these children play is in the playgrounds right outside in these areas. So.
Representative Mullery is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know, I've heard the statistic that inner city children of color in the Twin Cities are something like 17 times the suburban days of absences because of asthma. Do you know
That is true. That? They have the highest absenteeism medically of all our children. And again, there obviously are some genetic differences. The prevalence in the African-American population of asthma is approximately 50% higher than that in the Caucasian population. And remember, pollution doesn't cause asthma. Asthma is a genetic process, but on top of that predisposition, we are what we breathe. So there is that large environmental component also.
Madam Chair, follow up. I know that, for instance, on the north side in Minneapolis, there's pretty high rate of asthma absences. And there's recent testing done, for instance, down along some of the heaviest industry down there by the river that shows that the average day there's about the same amount of PM2.5s as the metro, but then there's quite a few days with high spikes. Do you know if there's a relationship between
that
the spikes and the days of absence? Or
the spikes of particulate pollution, these PM particulate matter, 2.5 microns in diameter. There are good studies to show that high levels are correlated with emergency room visits for asthma, with visits for pneumonia, and this is in childhood. And interestingly, changes in pulmonary function that we can actually measure with our equipment, our spirometers. And these are all published studies. This is pretty much appreciated and common knowledge at this time. I think I even included in here, this is just an example showing particle size and where in the lungs these are deposited. You're going over to the right-hand side there. Those are large particles, small particles in the middle. 1 micron is right in the middle. If you look at that 2.5 micron, it's moving toward the right-hand side there, and you can see that most of the deposit in the alveoli and in the airway. The particle size there, 2 microns, is what we look at. The majority of the particles, 2.5 microns, that you inhale do deposit in your lung tissue. There's no question about it. And I pulled this out this weekend. I was up in Duluth at our clinic, and I pulled this graph out of what happened this weekend, just to give you an idea of what happens to particulates in the 2.5 micron range and air quality. The green zone is safe zone. The yellow zone is a warning. The orange zone is unhealthy for patients who have an underlying disease like asthma. This was Friday, and if you remember, we had very, very cold weather over the last 2 weeks, and then a warm front moved in, and what happens when a warm front moves over cold air, the air below it is trapped, and there isn't a mixing of particles. And if you look at that little spike that moves up toward the orange in this picture, that was Friday morning when we had a thermal inversion. And people have studied these little spikes and looked at hospital admission and symptoms, and this is how we make those correlations. And that's just an example of what happened this weekend. We just touched that orange zone, unhealthy for people with asthma. This is how we kind of monitor symptoms.
Madam Chair, can I another couple questions. The EPA study that came out and why they lowered the amounts on 2.5s roughly a year ago. We all knew about the lung problems, but I was not that aware of the cardiac problems that they cited as being huge. Could you, in everything I've seen is so complicated medically that I had no idea, could you very quickly explain that? And then my second question is, I think it was about a year ago, someplace, some committee, I heard somebody from, I think it was the PCA, testifying that we didn't need to go lower than a 2.5, but then I know one place I asked was down at, I hate to raise Iowa as doing something right, but I was at a air pollution conference in Iowa put on by NCSL, and I know they're scientists from the University of Iowa, and I think Illinois said that we should be really going way below 2.5 into at least as low as 1, and also that we should be dividing and looking at the makeup of the compounds that are in that. Is there, first of all, what do you think of, and then I also got the same at NCSL in Atlanta last summer, but what do you think of that, and is there a way we could do that?
Well, fortunately, we have a cardiologist here today, a heart specialist, so that's there's going to be part of your answer there. And then the second part, I'd say lower is always better. I mean, there's none of us in the field would debate lower pollen counts, lower particulates, probably lower health effects. A comment about our warming temperature and higher carbon dioxide levels, and this is another particulate, pollens. The pollen counts internationally have been skyrocketing the past decade. And if there's extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, carbon, plants, you would think, would put that carbon into carbohydrates, into leaves, and into roots. But actually, plants put their extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere into pollen, into reproductive structures. So internationally, pollen counts have been zooming, and in the United States also. And that's another particulate that is very tiny. And if you're allergic, and 65% of children with asthma are also allergic, you are inhaling that extra pollen along with your PM2.5s and your ozone. And the effects on airways are cumulative over time.
Thank you. Representative Keith, next.
Madam Chair,
okay,
he hasn't had a chance to answer yet on the cardiac question.
We're going to have to another testifier.
Oh, okay.
On that. So we will definitely cover that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious. We talked about the smoking. Do we have any statistics to show how many of these children that are coming in have what the ratio is between smokers and non-smokers families?
If you just look at our number one, Minnesota Community Measurement requires us all who deal with asthmatic children to document whether they're smoking in the home. So we're required by law to document that. So every single hospital admission we have, we have a hard copy. And if you ask me, is smoking more prevalent in the homes of children admitted for asthma at our institution than it is in the general population? The answer is clearly yes. So these children also are at risk in the indoor environment or in automobiles of secondhand smoke exposure. There's no question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we don't know which is causing more of, is there a breakdown between which causes more of the asthma or not?
And I'm kind of glad that we don't know that exact breakdown, because it's this cumulative effect of everything that we have to consider as clinicians. If you're asking me, I want these patients and their parents to attempt to control every trigger factor in their environment. And in a comprehensive management program for our children with lung disease, that's what we try to do. We say, you know what, you chip away at everything that could potentially trigger pathology. And we try to work on every aspect of that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fabian, is your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, just to follow up on Representative Keel's question, so when you identify children at a young age who live in a home where there are smokers, do you have any information for us on what percentage of those adults, parents, stop smoking to enable their child to be more healthy?
I don't know if we have to rely on families being honest about their smoking habits. I think we have good success in having our parents smoke outside the home and outside the automobiles. I think cessation is a different story. I don't think we have great success with smoking cessation, but keeping it out of the indoor environment in the automobiles is what we work for. We really try to convince them to quit. There are a number of helplines, and we as pediatricians, believe it or not, are allowed to write prescriptions for nicotine replacement products and all the medications for smoking cessation. We as pediatricians can write them for our adults in the family, their caretakers. So there is a push to have us really intervene if we can.
Thank you, and I don't want to drag this out too much because I know we have a big agenda here, but I just sort of want to, I'm hearing, maybe I'm assuming that some of the direction of the questions here goes to, as we put together policies to try to address this, you know, how can we best attack this? Because you have this sector that, you know, some of us have asked about the smoking, which clearly we know that smoking has some pretty devastating impacts all the way around. And there are certain policies we try to have as a state to address that. But there is a certain personal responsibility aspect to that. And then we have the air pollution aspect where, you know, I as a citizen can't do much about the air pollution coming from the cars that are driving by me every day. So I think we're a little bit wrestling here with how do we find an appropriate balance between those two things. So I'd like to sort of give you a final question, if this is the final question to you, about, you know, how you might, what can you tell us about drawing that that balance? You've said a couple times that these are cumulative effects.
Yes.
And yet, you know, if we assume that as a we continually work on the smoking aspect of this, but we haven't really addressed the air pollution aspect of it so much, at least not with a direct eye toward the public health impact. So do you have a sort of a final comment that would kind of wrap those things together for us?
I think we're doing a much better job on indoor smoke and secondhand smoke than we are with grappling with the huge issue of our environmental particulates. That seems to be a more difficult issue to get to get our hands around. I would really say Minnesota has done a wonderful job of looking at just all issues of secondhand smoke. I think that next step is to look at those broader issues of the built environment and environmental exposures, particularly within the city. So I think we're on the right track. We've got to tackle that next level.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I'd like to go back to your slide that you have up there. You said that we, you used the term we, just about touched the orange.
Yeah.
Where in the state of Minnesota, where those green dots and so forth are, did that happen?
This was in the Twin Cities. Okay. I pulled this out. You see that right at the top. Trans bisite pollutants. This was measured right within the Twin Cities. I was in Duluth, and we were still green up there in Duluth that day. I usually look at these. These, by the way, are really easy to pull up the website, Air Now website. And this was pulled up from the Twin Cities.
Well, we're going to have some more testimony from PCA. This may be getting to your questions, if you'd like to wait. You don't have to.
Thank you. I don't want to. Thanks. So, Representative Liebling raised the issue about policymaking, and I want to just kind of get this on the table that you've talked a lot about the Twin Cities. I represent rural Minnesota, obviously, about as far away as you can get from here. Do you have statistics on hospital admissions and so forth for asthma and the relationship to particulates in rural Minnesota? And not that it's all that important today, but I just do want to caution the group that when we come to policymaking, Representative Liebling and others, you know, one size doesn't necessarily fit all. And I kind of want to have that on the table as a discussion item as we move forward. If you can respond to that if you want. If you don't want to, that's fine with me.
Yeah, there's variation over the entire state. And I think that's a good topic. One could look at asthma admissions the same way and say, look, we don't admit as many patients with asthma in outstate Minnesota. And we know here in the Twin Cities it's a disproportionate number from the inner city that we admit. So, you know, you bring up a good point. Where should our focus be when we look at environmental control? I think it's a reasonable question.
Well, I think we're going to move to our next speaker. If you want to just stay there, Dr. Kubik, I suspect we may come back to some questions. And would you? We're now going to do the cardiac, Representative Mullery and Dr. Lupker, would you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I will. I'm a Mac person, and this whole PC thing is very confusing to we Mac people. Thank you, Chair Wagenius, and committee members for inviting us. I'm Russell Lupker. I'm a cardiologist and epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota, and have been interested in issues surrounding air pollution and other factors related to cardiovascular disease. We all have heard or seen examples such as this. This is the London fog of 1952. Some of us may have missed that. But it wasn't a fog. It was air pollution related to what they heated and burned in London in those days, soft coal, diesel trucks, gasoline. And as you can see, the deaths in London during the week of that so-called fog quadrupled. And most of those deaths were due to cardiovascular disease. Now, we're not London in 1952, but I flew into L.A. back in November, and when you fly into L.A., look out the window, and this is what you see. Now, they've made significant progress. Of course, L.A., millions of cars, a natural basin surrounded by mountains, the wind going in the wrong direction and pushing everything in instead of out. But this is a picture of Minneapolis. And while we're not as bad as L.A., air pollution is an issue in this state as well. So what I'm going to talk about briefly today are the relationships to cardiovascular disease, the leading killer and cause of hospitalizations in this country, a growing body of population evidence that air pollution, particularly small particles that Dr. Kubik was talking about, are related both in the short term and the long term to the disease, that we know mechanisms from animal and other studies, and we know that controlling pollution, reducing it, reduces disease rates of cardiovascular disease. Much of what I'm going to talk about comes from serving on, for the second time, a committee for the American Heart Association, which came out with the scientific statement on this in 2010, a long statement, 47 pages, that reviewed all of the data that were available for cardiovascular disease and air pollution. So there are short-term effects. What are the short-term effects of air pollution that we know about? Heart attack, acute myocardial infarction, sudden death, and I might to that add to a lesser extent, stroke. There are also long-term effects. Atherosclerosis, the disease that underlies heart attacks and strokes, the narrowing of arteries that supply the brain and heart, seems to be aggravated and advanced by particulate matter in the air. So here are a couple of studies of short-term effects. These are interviews of people in the hospital with a heart attack, and they were asked, what were they doing an hour before they had that event? And as you can see, this is a study from Boston, that 3 to 4 times were in some area of roadway and traffic, everything from driving their cars to riding on a bus to bicycling. Or a study from Boston again and Augsburg in southern Germany and Bavaria, which shows 5 to 6 times the likelihood that these people will report that they were out doing this just before they had their event that tossed them in the hospital. Or, you know, in some instances, but obviously not studied here, sudden death. Now, I don't want to tell you that exercise is bad for you. But it's pretty clear that during the short term when you're exercising outside, you're at higher risk. The benefit comes from the other 23 hours of the day when you're at much lower risk by virtue of exercising. And so the average, not to discourage you from exercising, is on your side. I'm sorry I put in this slide because it's not very clear, but I'm going to tell you what it says and ask you to use your imagination. There are a wide varieties of epidemiologic studies of the long-term effects of smoking. These are studies here of 6 cities in the U.S., Oslo, Holland, the Nurses' Health Study, the American Cancer Society study, and the scale, which you can't see here, basically says particulate matter is related to increased levels of cardiovascular events. Particularly important to us, I think, because we were part of it, is the Women's Health Study, right there. This is 40,000 menopausal women, and a couple thousand of them were in the Twin Cities area, and it's clear that in this fairly recent study, 2007, that particulate matter was related to more cardiovascular events, particulate matter in the area in which they were living. This is a study from California that shows the long-term effects. And we study, one way we study non-invasively without poking needles in people, the status of your arteries is called intima medial thickening, IMP, which is the thickness of your carotid artery, the main artery that supplies your brain. And increased thickness is associated with increased atherosclerosis. It's very clear, and you can do it without without any damage to people to measure this. Well, this is in California, and as you can see in the graph there, as 2.5 micron particles increase in that environment, people who live there have increased thickening, indicating they have increased atherosclerosis. So when you bring all, there have been hundreds of studies together, we see a few things. We see both long and short-term increased mortality, death. We see increased hospitalizations, increased ischemic heart disease, and even modest increases in stroke and heart failure associated with particles in the air. Now, Dr. Kubik showed you a couple things about these small particles and how they're able to get in the smallest parts of the lung. But let me take them a step further. They're not only able to get into the smallest air sacs in the lung, they're actually able to squeeze between junctions between cells and get into the bloodstream. And it's been shown repetitively in lab animals that if you have them inhale particles, you can find them in the not long after actually in the bloodstream, where they do a variety of things. And these particles are not, as we'd like to think, just pieces of carbon. They're carrying all sorts of other compounds, heavy metals, organic compounds that you don't want in your lungs, but you don't want in your bloodstream either. And the result is they have a variety of effects on the vascular system that results in disease processes. This is just a complex slide that talks about some of these, but there are short-term effects in the lungs, and you heard some about asthma, but that engenders nervous system responses which may result in cardiac arrhythmias, abnormal heartbeats that sometimes lead to sudden death. And there are a variety of chronic effects that lead to more atherosclerosis. So to summarize, it's very clear that short-term exposure to particulates in the air can, in hours or weeks, trigger a cardiovascular event. It's very clear that it's not just susceptible people. Now, I've been asked at various times, I'm going to use a word epidemiologists use, it sounds terrible, called harvesting. And do, you know, are the people that die in a smog spike, are they very elderly, very sick people who finally the last thing pushed them over the edge? And that undoubtedly happens, and they might have died a week or a month later had this not happened. But it turns out that's not the main problem. The large body of American adults are susceptible. Because we already, most of us in this room, who aren't 20-year-old females, have disease in our arteries. And stimuli, or abnormal stimuli, such as this, has the potential to push someone into an arrhythmia or heart attack. And the data on that are very clear. Because biological mechanisms exist to explain this. So to end on a hopeful note from Ireland, a very nice place to visit, Ireland in before 1990, most houses were heated with soft coal and stoves and fireplaces and things like that, and they had trucks and cars churning up dust and spitting out dust, and they banned the use of those heating agents and converted people to gas and other cleaner things. And you can see the smoke particles in the left-hand graph from 84 to 90 dramatically falling after they reduced the pollution. And if you look to the right part of this graph, again, 1991 through 97, you see that cardiovascular deaths fell in the same time. And so the relationship is clear, and we can do something. Thank you.
Very good. Members, are there questions? You didn't talk specifically about the cost. We will be getting some of those figures from the PCA in a moment, but would you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I will comment on that. As Dr. Kubek said, the cost of a hospitalization for a asthma episode is substantial. The cost of hospitalization for a heart attack is in the $20,000-$40,000 range, even for the brief time we keep people in the hospital, 2-3 days now. The cost, for example, and the subsequent cost when a working age adult, you know, is limited or in some ways incapacitated after their event, is enormous. They may have to retire. Things like that happen. The costs of such things as a stroke are enormous, because frequently a stroke means lifelong care and no longer be able to perform usual functions, much less work. So the cost of these events is enormous, and among the leading, if not the leading, cost of health care in this state.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Doctor, thank you for your presentation. Very, very interesting. And I was trying to look up here quickly on my tablet to try to find some information about variation across the state, responding to Representative Fabian's question or comment about one size doesn't fit all. And certainly that's true. I mean, we know there's disease burdens and death rates from various things are going to vary across the state, because of varying conditions and different populations and for all kinds of reasons. But I wasn't able to find anything quickly, and I wonder if you'd have any comment on that, because, you know, clearly people get disabled and become ill and die everywhere. And, you know, but I guess the question would be, are you aware of any, or if either of you are aware of any sort of great differences in the impact of pollutants or the different disease rates across the state that are worth noting for us here today?
Yeah, I do know something about that, but let me tell you, the cardiovascular disease rates across this state are fairly even. This isn't an urban problem or rural problem. Alone. I recently have been involved in a study we've been doing in Hibbing. And so I've been looking at the data from Hibbing, because that's what we're studying. And if you look at the disease rates in Hibbing, they're not much different than St. Paul or Minneapolis, if you look over, take a long picture. And so, and if you look in small towns in Minnesota, smaller than Hibbing, and you visit practices there, these are not at all uncommon events in among the citizens there. Now, to attribute this to pollution, I think is a reach that may cause me to lose my science license. I think that we're talking about a multi-factor disease. We're talking about cigarette smoking, and we're talking about cholesterol and family history and things like that. And all of these things go together, and we need to work on all of them, perhaps except family history. And but pollution is just another burden to put on this, and it's, you know, personal, local burden if you smoke, and those around you in your household are exposed to that. But then you get into what kind of work you do. And I've wondered up in Hibbing, where mining is an important industry, you know, you're throwing a lot of particles into the air. But I have no specific data on that. I can only speculate.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was along Representative Liebling's line, because I, too, live up in the northwest corner of Minnesota and see a lot of cardiac events, have lived through a lot of fun events with family. And, you know, we talk about all the different issues, but up in the northwest area where, you know, our air is very clear, and I see a lot of people with heart issues that, you know, may have exposure to some things, but certainly not the pollution that you would in the metro area. So that was my concern was, you know, is it attributed to air quality?
Yeah, Representative Keel, I think that's harder to disentangle, you know, it may not be produced in the northwest corner, but it blows from somewhere. And I tell you a story here. I was on sabbatical in Gothenburg, Sweden, when Chernobyl blew. And guess where the cloud went from the Ukraine? There were a lot of panicked Swedes and Norwegians, because although the reactor wasn't there, those particles went up north, and ultimately they had to destroy the reindeer herd because of strontium. At any rate, you know, pollution that is here in an industrialized area doesn't just disappear into the ether. It may blow and undoubtedly blows into other more rural areas. So I don't think people are unexposed, but to talk about the northwest corner specifically, I don't have data on that. And it's likely the air is cleaner.
Representative Keel, the Pollution Control Agency comes up. I think we need to ask some questions about pollution coming up from the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of what is happening in Rochester, for example. So those questions, I think we will have opportunities to pursue those questions. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it occurs to me that kind of what you're the point of what you're pointing out to us with the research is that if there is something we can do to mitigate this problem, we ought to do it. It's our responsibility as legislators to see if we can address this issue. So I appreciate the background that you're giving us, even though we perhaps can't control every individual's behavior necessarily. Maybe there are things that we can do to address this problem, look at different kinds of policies that might encourage improving the pollution situation. So thank you for your information.
I don't see any other questions. I really appreciate your coming and helping us out here today, because it has been very helpful.
Thank you.
David, we're going to, and we invite you to hear the next presentations, which you may find interesting. We have David Bale and David Thornton from the Pollution Control Agency will be the next folks that are talking to us. And while we are doing that, would somebody move the minutes for?
I'll move approval of the minutes from yesterday's meeting.
Thank you. I don't see any questions or concerns. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any objection? The minutes are adopted. All right. Welcome to the committee. One of the things I think would be helpful is for you to remind us of what you brought to us before. We were in a busy session, and we had not a lot of time to talk about the dollar amounts we're dealing with here, but I think that it's timely to do that. Thank you. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for having us. My name is David Bale. I am an economic analyst at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And the purpose of my presentation is hopefully to do just what you just said. First of all, to compliment the excellent presentations from Drs. Kubik and Lupker, but with a more high-level summary of the health impacts of air pollution in Minnesota, and to very briefly recap what Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Health presented on this issue at the previous hearing last January that you referred to. All of what I am presenting, plus a bit more, is in the handout that we've provided, so I encourage you to look that over, and hopefully I'll touch on the main points that are there.
That's what I needed.
So the key messages that we hope are being conveyed today, not just from us, but from the other presenters as well, is that the human health impacts of air pollution are significant. And thus, improving air quality is an important realm for public policy and for improving public welfare. So the state of Minnesota has an important role to play in improving air quality and thereby improving Minnesotans' health. So, and finally, many of these health impacts are complex diseases, as we just heard in the previous presentations, that have multiple causes. But improving air quality is an important realm for addressing the problem and minimizing exacerbation of these conditions. So this slide just gives a very broad perspective of the health impacts of air pollution, not specifically for Minnesota, but nationally. And I think these five issues nicely sum up the problem. So one, breathing air polluted with particle pollution and ground level ozone can cause a variety of illnesses and even death, many of which we just heard about. Minnesota and the U.S. have certainly made great strides in reducing air pollution, but nonetheless, peer-reviewed studies still show that particularly fine particles and ozone pollution are still critical problems for our citizens' health. Second point here is that EPA scientists estimate that the exposure to air pollution contributes to roughly one of 20 deaths in the United States. And this is clearly higher in urban areas, but overall, one in 20 deaths. This equates to 130,000 deaths associated with air pollution in the U.S. every year, which for some perspective is considerably more than the total number of deaths from Alzheimer's disease or the total deaths from all accidents. Thirdly, EPA scientists also found that air quality improvements can provide significant public health benefits. For example, reducing exposures to fine particles and ozone nationwide by 33% would avoid about 43,000 premature deaths annually, as well as tens of thousands of non-fatal heart attacks, respiratory and cardiovascular hospitalizations, and hundreds of thousands of acute respiratory systems. Fourth, highly susceptible populations, including children and the elderly, bear a significant burden of air pollution. We heard from Dr. Kubik about some of the impacts in children, in upper and lower respiratory system symptoms, asthma exacerbation, school absences. And meanwhile, those aged 65 and older, the elderly, who died due to air pollution in 1 year lose a combined total of over 1 million years of life. So finally, the economic value of all these health impacts across the country exceeds $1 trillion every year. Vast majority of this is from the monetary value of pollution-related deaths, but the cost to society of heart attacks, hospital admissions, emergency department visits, and missed school and work is over $25 billion annually. All right, so now we're going to narrow the focus a little bit and look at Minnesota. I'm going to briefly talk about a couple of recent studies by the PCA and the Department of Health. We've both recently examined the health impacts of air pollution in Minnesota. Each of these studies has taken a slightly different approach, but the key message of each is the same, and that is that even though Minnesota's air quality is generally quite good, the total health burden of particulate and ozone pollution is significant, particularly the impacts of fine particle pollution. Here are some of the health impacts that we've looked at for fine particles in ozone. So the pyramid image here conveys the fact that the most severe impacts at the top of the pyramid affect the fewest number of people, with premature death being the most severe at the very top of the pyramid. And as we move down the pyramid, the health impacts become less severe but affect more and more people. So at the bottom of the pyramid, where we see the various respiratory symptoms, these can impact or can affect hundreds of thousands of people in Minnesota. So the recent work that MPCA did used EPA's predictive models for measuring the health impacts of air pollution. So these models are based on a vast array of epidemiological literature as well as health valuation literature, and they are currently the most reputable peer-reviewed models for modeling the health impacts of air pollution, both the actual number of impacts as well as the economic values of these impacts. So the handout we gave you gets into a little more detail on the specific our specific estimates, our findings, but this slide summarizes the general results, and that is that across the state, air pollution, particularly fine particles, is likely responsible for a few thousand premature deaths annually and millions of some of the less severe non-fatal health impacts. The estimated economic value of premature deaths caused by air pollution is quite high. It's in many billions of dollars just in Minnesota annually. And the estimated total economic value of all other health impacts of particulate and ozone pollution in Minnesota is about $400 million per year. So this next slide summarizes the Minnesota Department of Health examination of this issue. So they approached the same issue, but from a slightly different angle. Rather than using the predictive modeling that we did, they've examined actual local data on daily hospitalization counts modeled against daily air quality values over time. They've done this in both the seven county metro area as well as in Olmsted County over the period of 2003 through 2009. So this table summarizes their findings. This is just for the seven-county metro area. But you can see in this table, for example, that that they found that fine particles caused 1.9% of all hospitalizations. This is in the metro area for all respiratory diseases, resulting in annual hospitalization costs of about $1.6 million. And then there's some more findings for asthma and for lower respiratory diseases. So just to sum up this very brief presentation, first of all, Minnesota's total health burden attributable to fine particles and ozone pollution is substantial, and reducing pollution will improve the health of Minnesotans. And finally, we've not recently examined the costs of reducing air pollution. However, national studies that compare the benefits of reduced air pollution to the costs have consistently found that the benefits far outweigh the costs. So this has just been a brief summary. Hopefully it sets the table for the upcoming presentations on specific things that we can do about that. But that's all I have. Thank you.
Very good summary. I appreciate it. Questions from members? I don't see any questions right now. Assistant Commissioner Thornton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Thornton from the Pollution Control Agency. And we're now going to transition a little bit from the health side of this and the excellent presentations that you've heard so far to a little more about our level of concern and what we are thinking about. Clearly, we have pretty good air quality here in Minnesota. We meet EPA's national ambient air quality standards, and yet we still, based on the information that you've heard already today, we still have health being impacted by levels of air pollution that we have here. Perhaps it's short-term exposures that contribute to elevated levels of air pollution, even in limited geographic areas, but that do not cause us to exceed EPA's national ambient air quality standards. And so that causes us to wonder, what should we be doing to try to minimize these risks? We pulled together a group of folks over the last year to sit down with us, look at the data, and talk about it. And the following presentations are going to be based on some of the results of that effort. But one of the things that became clear is that the traditional sources of air pollution that you think about, the factories and power plants, are becoming a smaller and smaller part of the problem here in Minnesota. They represent only about a quarter of the emissions that we put up into the atmosphere of all pollutants, and they are quite heavily regulated, and the regulations continue to tighten over time as EPA updates their requirements and standards are tightened. The other three quarters of the pollution comes from what we have been referring to as, in our jargon, mobile and area sources, and often that doesn't mean much to people, but essentially non-permitted sources, sources that we don't directly regulate, such as residential and commercial buildings, and that would include schools and malls and office buildings, as well as our homes and apartment buildings, off-road vehicles and equipment, which includes recreational equipment, construction equipment, lawn and garden and landscaping equipment, and yes, even tractors and farm equipment, and on-road vehicles, so cars and trucks and buses and things like that. And they each contribute about, each one of those sectors that I just mentioned contribute about a quarter of the problem. So it's very clear to us that to make any inroads on this issue, we're going to need to try to get emission reductions from those non-traditionally regulated sectors of the what we have been calling mobile and area sources, and what we're going to start now referring to as non-point air sources. You may be familiar with the term non-point water, and the situation is similar. It's thousands of sources that are not regulated by traditional EPA command and control type regulations, and what we're thinking about is not necessarily additional regulation, but additional programs to help try to achieve reductions in those areas, and that's going to be what you'll be hearing about from the other speakers today. Real briefly, there were a number of questions that came up earlier today that I think you'll find are well answered in our biennial report to the legislature that we put out in January of 2013. You can find it on our website. It's located under the Air tab and under the Reports tab under that. But very briefly, air pollution in Minnesota is highest in the Twin Cities and in the southeastern corner of the state, which includes Olmsted County and Rochester, and decreases as you move to the north and typically to the northwest. And that is largely due to the population density in the Twin Cities in southeastern Minnesota, the density of sources, as well as proximity to other large metropolitan areas to the south of us and a little bit to the east of us. There is a transport component to pollution events in Minnesota. When air pollution is high in Minnesota, we are generally getting some contribution from other states. That'll differ with each event. Some events we're most for with each event. Some events we're contributing most of the problem, and in other events it'll be distant sources. One that comes to mind is sometimes in the summertime when there are forest fires in Canada or Colorado. Those trigger air pollution alerts and events here in Minnesota. So it all depends on the event. We've got more data on that, and we can get back to you on it if you'd like at a later period and talk a little bit more about the transport aspects. But I encourage you to take a look at our legislative report if you have more questions about monitoring and levels and sources. And if you don't have any questions, or if you do, I'm happy to answer them. But if you don't, we've got other speakers ready to go.
Well, yes, Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about this. And maybe now is not the time to address it, but I think that the issue that was discussed a little bit earlier about the different locations, and I hope that we're going to be addressing some of that, because I think it is really clear that one size doesn't fit all, and yet, you know, we know there's a dose response to pollution, and, you know, so with just what you said about the contribution from distant places, you know, it immediately sort of raises the question in my mind of how much we can really do in a state as opposed to nationally or internationally. But I'm sure you're going to be addressing that. But I just sort of wanted to bring those issues up because I know they're kind of on my mind, and I'm sure other members are thinking about the same sorts of issues.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thornton, you mentioned a non-point source of large engines type things, trucks, tractors, and such. I believe as of January 1st, the EPA has finalized their Tier 4 final emission standards for diesel engines, large trucks, large engines, and such. Will that have a positive impact as we go ahead in terms of reducing the diesel NOx emissions, things like that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, it absolutely will have a major impact. It's going to take a number of years as the for the fleet to turn over. And you know, EPA has improved their regulation of all mobile engines, not just passenger vehicles, but also trucks and other heavy-duty diesel engines over the last few years. And all of that is great, and there's going to be significant benefit, but it will take a number of years because of the fact that those engines don't turn over as fast as they used to. The automobiles last longer, and diesel engines traditionally have stayed in the fleet for much longer than that.
I don't see any more questions. Thanks, and thanks for the summary. That was very nice.
Thank you.
Okay. Jim Urkel and Tony Poilus together are coming up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and for the record, I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I think you've heard a number of issues today regarding air quality and how important it is in the state of Minnesota and its impacts on our citizens and their health. You've heard the numbers. I thought the doctors did a great presentation on telling you what their impacts are, and I think Representative Liebling and you have touched on also how many factors. There are a lot of moving parts, whether it's transport or it's transient from Chicago or from forest fires, and how it moves around. But I think what Jim and I would like to discuss is a proactive approach that we're taking here in Minnesota under the leadership of the Pollution Control Agency and the Environmental Initiative. Some of you might have remembered them as the Minnesota Environmental Initiative, and I still have a hard time not saying that. I'm sorry, Mike. But under the leadership of the PCA and Mike Hartley and Gina Gerard over there have done a spectacular job in putting together a stakeholders group that involves businesses, environmental groups, other nonprofits, and state and local governments to try and take a proactive approach to address this situation. We've gone through, there was a group that got together of a number of folks, like I said, from a variety of organizations that went through, and the phase one, if you will, of the Clean Air Minnesota Dialogue identified 24 issue areas that we could move forward on in a variety of issue, six areas of that we could move forward on, including area sources, energy efficiencies, mobile diesel, point and non-point, and transportation management were some of the areas that we talked about to go through. So we identified those 24 issues, and now we're into phase two. We've tried to go through, and by the end of this year in 2014 and into a little bit of 2015, to go through and identify and evaluate and prioritize those issues, and then go through and see where we can develop and fund them and implement them and make sure where there are some that are easier than others, some where there's grants and loans available and we can work with other partners that we can talk about, and then to go through and make sure that we can track so that we have achievable outcomes that we can show the PCA and the EPA as we move forward on these air quality regulations. It's important, obviously, to the business community. You've heard about the cost in terms of health impact. It's also important to us because of a number of restrictive regulations that would occur if we would go into what's called non-attainment. We've come close, as you've heard, a couple of times each time that EPA changes their regulation, specifically in ground-level ozone and PM2.5. Some of you will remember the vehicle emission inspection program that we had here in the state of Minnesota. We don't have that anymore, but that would be just one example if we would go into non-attainment. That would be one possible requirement that would be required for us to become back into attainment. There are other options to go through, but this is why we're taking a proactive approach through the leadership of environmental initiative to try and go through and identify, as I said, these 24 recommendations and move them forward with other partners. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Jim.
If I could just ask, as we are talking about this, I am not clear whether your goal is just to stay within the federal level, or is your goal to actually reduce the community costs that we're paying for help by actually reducing the amount of air pollution? Do you have goals that are stretch goals that go beyond just saying we want to stay within the federal level?
Madam Chair, I'll let Mike Hartley, when he comes up, address that a little bit further. But my personal goal is, yes, that if we try and reduce and track these emissions, we're already, as Mr. Thornton has pointed out, we're below the federal right now. We're just worried as they update the NAAQS, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, as they update those, that we would go into non-attainment. And we're below them right now. But as we go through, we would hope that there would be a variable connection there between as we're lowering on these 26 recommendations and lowering the air quality, you know, lowering our outputs, if you will, that will directly, hopefully, help the communities that are being affected, specifically in the health impacts that they go through, that there's a direct correlation there, that as we lower our air emissions, that would help, hopefully, those health impacts.
Yeah, my specific question is, as we're going through this, are there specific benchmarks or goals that we have, or do we just have the goal of staying below the federal standard? And if we don't have specific benchmarks, why wouldn't we adopt specific benchmarks so we can see the outcomes for what we're doing?
Madam Chair, again, I'll leave that up to Mr. Hartley when he comes up a little bit more, but I think it would be difficult in certain areas, depending on whether it's in mobile sources or area sources, to hit specific benchmarks. And like I said, I'd rather let Mike answer the question to go through. And I know, because we're developing those right now and implementing them and trying to set up those tracking standards so that we have outcomes for that.
I was just talking about outcomes for the air, not for a specific mobile or whatever, but in general, do we have benchmarks? I will wait and ask that question. Mr. Urkel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Urkel, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. More than 10 years ago, MCEA and the Minnesota Chamber helped found and since then have co-chaired Clean Air Minnesota, which is a coalition of business organizations, environmental NGOs, and government agencies that are committed to using voluntary approaches to reduce air pollution and to maintain Minnesota's attainment status under the Clean Air Act. You've heard testimony this morning about the enormous public health benefits that we can achieve by reducing fine particulates and ground level ozone levels. The problem we face, as Mr. Thornton has mentioned, is that our existing regulatory regime really isn't set well to deal with the problem that we face today. The problem we face today with air pollution is very similar to the one that we face with water pollution. Our laws address big point sources, but they don't adequately deal with, as using David's taxonomy, the non-point source sources. With water, it's agricultural runoff and groundwater contamination. With air, it's things like mobile diesel, backup generators, residential wood smoke, and vehicle miles traveled. Problems that require a different set of approaches that need to be taken. Clean Air Act, or the Clean Air Minnesota Coalition, has been doing a lot of work to identify and implement those different kinds of approaches. For more than a year, with the help and facilitation of Environmental Initiative, we've had a work group that's met to research and analyze possible ways of reducing fine particulates and ground level ozone, and we've reached a consensus on 24 recommendations. Those recommendations, at least to address a little bit your point about the thresholds, in trying to figure out what we needed to do, we looked at what we thought EPA was going to be doing in setting the ambient air quality standards, and then we tried to build into that a margin of safety, and then we tried to figure out what actions needed to be taken in order to hit that measure that margin of safety. So at least in part, we did try and set that. I don't think we did it in quite the way that you're talking about with hard thresholds, but we did build in that notion of a margin of safety in coming up with the recommendations.
I think this is an extremely important that we look at conceptually what we're doing, and we haven't really looked at the financial impact on Minnesotans. And so just having the federal standard and having this margin so we don't hit the federal standard is protective of us in one way. It protects the business community from having additional regulations. But we aren't getting at the other issue, which is Representative Liebling's budget. It's not my budget, it's hers. And that is, I think, the fundamental issue that we haven't addressed and why we need to meet jointly. We are, I have felt a little bit embarrassed about our not tackling this issue, and it's probably not so much on my mind because this committee, I mean the Environment, Natural Resources, and Ag Finance, is not spending the money like in water. It's different. So in water, we have that total responsibility. But but in air, the responsibility for not doing a good job shifts to Representative Liebling. So that's why I think we have to conceptually rethink how we're setting our goals. And that's why I bring that up now, because I feel like we're in old think and not in understanding the numbers that we have been developed.
And we do exist in a dynamic regulatory environment. And so the science is showing that there are public health impacts at lower and lower levels. That's being reflected in how EPA is coming at these things. We've been comfortable with the form of regulation that we've had, but now we're not being able to hit those. Trying to come up with ideas that will catch up with all of that is difficult, and I appreciate that. But almost anything that you do that will reduce fine particulate and the emissions that result in fine particulates and ground level ozone are almost no regrets kinds of policies. You reduce those. If you come up with any reduction at all, it will translate at some point into better public outcomes. It's either that, or you find some way of taxing the externalities that we're putting onto the health system, and that's a whole other discussion that I don't think even Environment Initiative would be willing to tackle. Although Mike.
Yeah, and could I just come too?
Yes,
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and
You know, while I appreciate, you know, the framing it in terms of our Health and Human Services budget, of course, that's only a small capture of the cost. You know, the real issue is the impact on the health of Minnesotans and what that means for us with the ramifications throughout. So, you know, but I appreciate the comment. You know, whatever we do to reduce those extra burdens, I think the evidence shows from our previous two testifiers that we will see, it may not solve the problem. We're never going to, you know, let's face it, we're never going to solve the problem of people dying from disease, right? You have to die from something, as people often say, but premature deaths and, you know, things that are avoidable that are based on, understanding the impacts, I think we clearly can do a much better job. Although we may not know at this point, you know, what the ideal level might be, I guess that's our work to try to find that proper balance.
Representative Mueller.
Madam Chair, I just want to strengthen what you pointed out. Is it seems like this is to meet the EPA standards, and yet everybody we heard from the two earlier, the same thing I'm hearing from university experts all over the country is that it's the EPA 2.5 is nowhere near what we need to get down to, or with regard to what's in that, what compounds. And it's affecting our achievement gap, it looks like. There's studies that show that.
Absolutely.
Which in turn affects our employment rates in Minnesota and everything. So it's not just a budget of a health committee. It's everything across the board.
I can remember from earlier testimony, Representative Mullery, that when we looked at asthma and the costs, we were not including the costs of children missing school. So we would not be including anything related to achievement gap or those costs. So the costs are larger than I think what PCA has given us is conservative. I mean, that's fair of them to do that, but nobody has developed the cost that you brought up earlier. It's just the things we have are solid, but there are additional costs that have not been included.
Madam Chair, just as you indicated, you also have to look at the costs from not meeting a much lower standard, a higher standard than EPA.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a discussion. We're not in session. We don't have a bill. We do need to figure out where we need to be, and that's what this is all about. So if you want to continue.
I'm not certain that you have the recommendations that came out of the Cleaner Minnesota Dialogue. So we have them. They're also available in the report that Environment Initiative.
Why don't you hand them?
So as Mr. Polis mentioned, the work group and Clean Air Minnesota are continuing to work on the recommendations. Now we're looking at what's needed to get them going. Some of them are already being undertaken, but a number of them need a push to really get started. And at the moment, we're trying to identify what that combination of push really should be. Some of the recommendations will require legislative change, and some will require support through possible public funding that would be used as a match for public sector investment. And all of this really turns on leadership from business, and we're very fortunate that the business community is clearly motivated and engaged on this, and that we've been able to partner for so long with the Minnesota Chamber.
Did you have anything else you want?
No.
Any questions for members? I don't hear any. I would comment on one thing. I'm just looking at this energy efficiency. That is energy efficiency, members. I do sit on the Energy Commission, and energy efficiency is clearly going to be one of the issues for the commission.
efficiency saves us money now, not just in air pollutants, but it saves us in the costs of building additional facilities to generate power. So I see now three silos sitting here that we need to merge, and that that one in particular, and I suspect that Representative Hornstein should probably be at the table for the transportation. All of these things are together, and but some of them have other reasons to concentrate on too, and those might be ones we want to highlight.
Madam Chair, in case any of you want to dive into the detail behind the recommendations, we did a lot of work in the working group to vet a number of the recommendations, and in the report from an Environment Initiative or the Environmental Initiative, you'll see that we tried our best to identify what kind of benefit you'd get in terms of air pollution reduction, what kinds of co-benefits might run with the recommendation, and then a look at the effectiveness, the economic effectiveness of the recommendation itself. So we tried to crank numbers in terms of dollars per pound reduced, things like that. So in looking at those, you may decide that we didn't pick the right ones, but I think you can see the rationale that we used to come up with the list of recommendations.
Any questions, members? Okay, I don't see any. We will now have, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Mike Barley from Environmental Initiative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Mike Harley, who you've heard so much about already, and I'm the Executive Director of Environmental Initiative. We're the group that helped with the PCA to convene the Clean Air Dialogue. We're the organization that houses Clean Air Minnesota. We're the organization that's coordinated Project Green Fleet, which is the success story in reducing diesel emissions that I'm going to talk about in a moment. But first, I want to respond to some of the questions that came up with the previous speakers about targets. So in the Clean Air Dialogue this past year, we did set some initial targets, Madam Chair, and those were to reduce fine particles PM2.5 by 20% and to reduce ground level ozone by 10%. Those are our initial targets, and they need refining, and we'll continue to refine those targets, but we have them. And I should say, too, that we haven't quantified those health benefits yet, but we should, and we certainly could. So that's there's more work to be done.
That would be helpful for all of us, I think.
Yes. Also wanted to point out that certainly reducing emissions to remain in compliance with federal standards is important, but it's not the only important thing that we do. We're equally concerned with reducing exposure, especially exposure in communities that face disproportionate risk. And so you'll hear as I talk about Green Fleet that we seek those communities where diesel emissions can be brought down and reduce exposure. So it isn't only about remaining in compliance with the standard, it's also about health benefit. We've heard a lot from PCA on this topic. It's great. We appreciate their leadership. I also want to point out that the Department of Health is a major leader in our work as well. We have a number of representatives from the department here today, and I would encourage you in future hearings to bring their perspective into this. We're also working closely with the U of M School of Public Health. We're working with the Minnesota Public Health Association, and all of that will be important as we quantify those health benefits. So with that, let me say that we're going to switch to the action part of this. It's not all about talk. It's important to have dialogue. It's important to set goals. But ultimately, if what we care about is clean air, we need to act. We need to implement. We need to get the outcomes. And so Laura Babcock and I are going to talk about two examples where we have already achieved some success and where there's more potential to reduce emissions. And specifically, I'm going to talk about Project Green Fleet, which gets to Representative Anderson's question about the legacy fleet. Engine standards have improved, but diesel engines run for a long time. And so Project Green Fleet is an initiative to address those emissions from that legacy fleet. And specifically, we're retrofitting existing engines with pollution control equipment, idle reduction equipment, and reducing pollution, reducing exposure. And you can see some of the fleets we've worked with around the state to do that. tribal, public, and private fleets. This is a project that's coordinated by our organization, and I want to talk a little bit about funding, because that is so important in making this happen. You know, we have the fleets, we have the willing partners, we simply need the resources to do it. And our goal in Project Green Fleet has always been to make participation as easy as possible. Nobody has to do this. There's no requirement. There is no regulatory driver at this stage to force anybody's hand. And so a fleet will only agree to do this because we make it easy for them to do it and because they believe in the value of it. And so with school bus fleets, which I'll talk about, a major focus of our work, we strive to make that no cost to the fleet, completely free to the fleet owner. And then with other fleets, heavy-duty fleets that we'll talk about, we try to keep that cost as low as possible. I do want to talk for a moment about where some of that money has come from and to acknowledge that since 2005, we've raised about $10 million for this program. Only about $3 million of that came through the state. We appreciate the wisdom of the Minnesota legislature in appropriating that money. It was important. But the remaining money of that 10 came from a combination of private sources, about $2 million in private funding, both from businesses and from health organizations and from foundations, and then also federal money, about $5 million in federal money, including a stimulus grant of about $3 million. We're not so optimistic about the prospects for federal money in the future, but I'll come back to later why that combination of public and private money is so important. I'm not going to belabor the point about the benefits, the health benefits. We've talked about it a lot today. We can talk more about it, but there are health, environment, and economic benefits to doing this. I do want to make the point that since 2005, we've worked all around the state. You can see each one of those dots represents a fleet that we've worked with. The bright green, it's not that bright, is it? But the bright green is heavy-duty or construction fleets. The mustard yellow is school bus fleets, of course. And then olive green is both. And so you've seen we've made an effort, because this is not only about remaining in compliance with the standard, we've made an effort to reduce exposure everywhere, across the state, everywhere that we can. Right? If we were only concerned about non-attainment, we might be focused purely on the metropolitan area, and we are not. We've retrofitted 3,200 school buses to date. We have only about 90 left in the state, and we will be done.
Let me ask a question right
yes.
away on that.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Were you including the fleet that takes little kids to Head Start?
We specifically, thank you, Madam Chair, for that question. That's one of our favorite parts of the story. We had a grant specifically from Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation to focus on Head Start buses. And so the metropolitan area Head Start buses have been retrofitted, or at least those that were diesels. It turns out many of those buses are not diesel. But the diesel fleets have been retrofitted, and that was purely through private resources.
And for not metro area, because it really is for the children, what about not metro area?
You know, what we found is that most Head Start buses are not diesel, okay. And so we ended up shifting that focus away. We did what we could, and then moved on to other fleets.
Thank you
for that question. So we will be not the first, but one of the first states to retrofit all of our school buses, and we've done that. Completely voluntarily, completely proactively, with a combination of public and private resources. So that's something we can really be proud of and should be proud of. We've also worked on more than 400 heavy-duty diesel engines, and that means construction and transit buses, trains, construction equipment, refuse haulers. I also want to make the point that Project Green Fleet is the private nonprofit arm of the work, but we work in close collaboration with the PCA, and there is a PCA program that is doing very similar work, and you can see on this map, the statewide map, where some of that work has taken place. Between 2009 and 2011, that represents PCA stimulus grant projects to reduce pollution from diesel emissions, and then the metro planning map shows CMAQ, Congestion Mitigation Grant, and there were 425 retrofits through that project. Before I talk about the PCA's outcomes, I just want to note that the school buses that are listed here could be seen as double counting because the appropriation that the legislature made in 2008 to the PCA was in part passed along to Environmental Initiative to do that school bus work. So you can't simply add the 1,900 buses here to the 32 that I had on a previous slide. But But the PCA's efforts has resulted in work on 2,800 engines around the state, 1,900 school buses, most of which were done through our program, 425 public trucks in the metro, which I just mentioned, and 287 engines statewide. And APUs is a little bit of jargon, but auxiliary power units that allow allow engine operators to not idle if they want to keep their vehicles warm. So, what's next? It's important to quantify the benefits of what we've done. And the metric that we found that's compelling and clear and that the media has absorbed and been able to use is car equivalents. And so we talk about the total pollution reduction and then the equivalent number of cars you'd have to remove from the road to reduce that. And so if you look at the combined efforts of PCA and Project Green Fleet, the total equivalent reduction would be 750,000 cars from the road a year, which is a staggering number. It's a huge number, right? And it's impressive. We can do more. We have $1 million contribution to Project Green Fleet right now from Flint Hills Resources that will allow us to finish the school buses in the next year. So by this time next year, we will have completed it. We should have a party to celebrate that. And then to really expand our work on those other heavy-duty fleets, because there's much more work to be done. But we need to set a high goal. We haven't yet determined what that next target should be. If we've done 750,000 car equivalent reduction already, what should that target be? I know that my organization feels that we could easily double what we've done. Just the green fleet portion of that is 425,000 cars. We believe that just our program, with sufficient resources, could achieve 1 million. Car reduction. The state's goal should be bigger than that. Should be bigger, because working together, public and private sector can do more. And then I just want to close by saying, reminding you that it was that combination of public and private resources that made this possible in the first place. We're not here to talk to you about a request. We're not here to talk to you about public funding. But it's hard for us to imagine how we will be able to achieve the real potential of this program in the coming years without some significant investment from the state. I do think that there will be a significant investment from the private sector as well. The involvement of the chamber reflects the commitment that the private sector has to this. The $1 million contribution that we have right now from Flint Hills Resources reflects the private sector's contribution. But it will be that combination of public and private that's important to making this work. And with that, I'm complete. Thank you.
Representative.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you. This is really impressive. And you know, kind of going back to the thing about regional differences and so on, I mean, as I recall hearing about the problem with the school buses, you know, you've got a school bus idling and you've got a bunch of school children standing next to it.
That's right.
So even if you're in a place with generally low pollution, you're getting a concentrated dose. So this is just a wonderful thing to hear about. And also just to comment on your last point there about the need for public funding in this, I think possibly this is what Chair Wagenius is going toward, that if we understand that this is really an investment that saves money, it may very well save a lot of money in the state budget or in other kinds of impacts, like what Representative Mullery was talking about, it makes it a lot easier to make the investments that we have to make to get these kinds of results. But thank you very much. It's great to hear about.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius and Representative Liebling. I'll just make the point that as we think about exposure, some of the kids who ride school buses in greater Minnesota, I grew up in rural New York and had a 45-minute bus ride every day, so they spend a lot of time on those buses. And not only are they exposed when they're standing outside the bus, but they're exposed inside the bus cabin as well.
And it's a lot worse in the back of the bus than the
That's
front
right.
of the bus.
That's right.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. Thank you. I think we're going to go on to Ms. Babcock.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation to speak to you this morning. My name is Laura Babcock, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program. MNTAP is a grant-funded program housed at the University of Minnesota in the School of Public Health that provides free, confidential technical assistance to Minnesota businesses to promote pollution prevention, energy efficiency, and resource conservation. Our team of engineers and scientists is able to provide direct site-based assistance to position companies for enhanced resource utilization, and in the process end up saving them significant money in their processes and improving their overall competitiveness. MNTAP is very proud to be a partner in the Clean Air Minnesota efforts and is collaborating with the Small Business Assistance Unit at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on an effort focused on area source VOC reduction. VOCs, or volatile organic compounds, are a significant contributing factor to the formation of ground-level ozone and smog. Outreach to reduce area source air pollution is a new focus in this round of Clean Air Minnesota efforts that will expand our outreach from the more easily identified and measured point sources, as David Thornton had indicated, to sources of emission that are highly dispersed, non-permitted area source generators. These are businesses that release volatile solvents of some type through any number of a variety of processes, from cleaning operations to the use of formulated products in integral to creating their products. This project is providing MNTAP with an opportunity to expand our technical assistance services to clients we have had limited success in reaching previously. Specifically, we will be seeking opportunities to engage very small business owners and those operating in underserved communities. These businesses are prime MNTAP clients, as they often are very small businesses and do not have the time or internal resources to make this type of significant business change on their own. While there are many challenges in targeting area source VOCs, specifically locating them, and developing trust-based relationships and understanding the broad range of technologies that are being utilized and the materials involved, as well as identifying suitable and cost-effective alternatives, there are significant upside opportunities for this type of technical assistance, specifically improving work area indoor air quality, local air quality, as well as improving worker health and safety. So how large is the VOC reduction opportunity from area sources? We have estimated that there are about 80 million pounds per year of VOCs released from this selection of the outreach targets that we feel we can address over the course of this Clean Air Minnesota timeline. This is just under 10% of the total estimated VOCs released in Minnesota. This sector includes several coating operations, specifically architectural surface coatings and automotive painting. It also includes releases from storage tanks, so these would be from tank farms. This would be also releases on filling service station storage tanks as well, underground storage tanks. A broad range of degreasing opportunities and categories, as well as graphic arts, basically printing facilities all the way to t-shirt shops. The emissions from fiberglass reinforced plastics is also included here. I'd like to illustrate our approach to decreasing VOCs emissions through examples in this coating industry outreach. Our goal is to reduce VOC emissions from solvent-based coatings. This will be done in two ways. One will be providing training for operators in painting situations so that they can improve their transfer efficiency. So that would be improving their ability to take the product from the can and put it on the part more efficiently, putting more of the product on the part and less being sprayed out into the air, as well as improving providing opportunities for non-VOC alternative adoption. So this would be the source reduction option, and this is obviously the larger opportunity. It is also the more costly opportunity, so that would be providing alternative materials and chemicals and training and helping to have businesses engage in replacement of those options. So from this standpoint, we would be looking at replacing VOC-containing paint formulations to waterborne or powder-coated paint alternatives. The picture on this slide is from a virtual paint training module that utilizes paint application equipment and computer interface technology to provide real-time feedback to operators on their painting application efficiency and the quality of the products they're producing. This type of training will be contracted from the University of Northern Iowa to provide near-term training for current paint operators. We will be seeking to have this training technology evaluated for possible implementation within Minnesota for continued workforce training in this area. Another tool we plan to use to reduce VOC emissions is demonstration projects of alternative technologies. We will engage lead users to share the impact that transitions have had to waterborne coating technologies have had on their business models. Coupling this with vendor assistance, training and support from associations and other partners, as well as bringing grant and loan funds to bear to facilitate adoption of these new and cleaner technologies will help speed these transitions to less polluting alternatives. Throughout all these efforts, building relationships is going to be a key to success. It's going to be a key to engagement. It's going to be a key to adoption of these new alternatives. I will close by letting you know a few near-term events that we have planned. We are partnering with the Minnesota chapter of the Chemical Coaters Association to offer training for painters in February. In March, we are planning a workshop on waterborne autobody paint coating options that will be hosted by a Minneapolis business owner who has been a leader in transitioning his shop away from solvent-based paints. This workshop will be conducted in partnership with the City of Minneapolis, paint and equipment vendors, as well as local community partners to help engage the local community, to engage the business members and get them to come to the event. I hope I've given you an idea of the scope of the activities that MNTAP is launching with our partners to decrease area source VOCs, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to present this work to you today.
Are there questions, members? Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, I just wanted a question unrelated to the testifiers before we adjourn.
I don't see any questions here. Thank you all, and I look forward to seeing the new numbers so we can see where we are going with health care costs. That's critically important. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to comment or testify? Yes, you are welcome to come up. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Please put your name on the record.
Is this working? My name is Alan Muller. I live in Red Wing, and I would like to share a thought or a question regarding the MPCA's role in all this. I've been to a certain extent involved in a long drawn out controversy involving a garbage incinerator in Minneapolis, and what I have seen is that the PCA advocates garbage incineration very strongly as a matter of policy. Now, it is clear that burning garbage is a major source of health damaging air pollutants. Certainly it is to residents of the neighborhood surrounding the Herc burner in Minneapolis. And I see a certain conflict between the goal of improving the health of Minnesotans by reducing air pollution and the other policy of promoting garbage incineration when there are alternatives such as source reduction programs and increased recycling and so on that can improve waste management without causing damage to our health. So at some point it would be very helpful, I think, to hear from the PCA about why it continues to promote garbage incineration. Small anecdote on that point. A year or so ago, the PCA rolled out a Metro Solid Waste Plan, which calls for, among other things, increased utilization of garbage burners, and the public input into that was one meeting, and at that meeting someone asked a question about how health considerations were factored into the PCA's thinking on solid waste planning for the metro area, and the answer was that that had not been a factor in the thinking, and I believe that that was a correct answer, but probably not the answer that ideally would have been given. So I think we could use some progress on connecting the talk and the action, at least in this area. Thank you.
Thank you for making that point. I appreciate it. I think that's one of our neighborhoods that does have high health impacts. So I appreciate that comment. Okay. Representative McNamara, I'm going to announce that we have our next hearing on January 28th at 8:15. It has been posted for a while. So with that, what would you like to comment?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. And my thoughts and conversation are directly related to that. Madam Chair, you do have two meetings scheduled, February 11th and February 12th, and you and I have exchanged some emails about those meetings. And I just think it's unfortunate that we're meeting those days instead of the week that the speaker designated for us to meet, January 27th to the 30th. You did allude that we do have one meeting scheduled that week. The speaker, a while back, I believe in December, and I'm looking at the email from him that said that we should set aside that week, realizing that we have travel plans, other jobs, and improve attendance. And Madam Chair, I think our attendance at this meeting shows that it's important that we plan ahead. And the speaker told us to do that, and then you have scheduled two meetings later in February, and one of them about a really important topic, the PolyMet. And the reality, there's actually a PolyMet hearing that week in the metropolitan area. That Tuesday, we could capture all those people already here, and they could come to this hearing on the week that the speaker told us to meet. The other thing that we need to consider, this is a committee that's blessed to have a strong rural influence, which is expensive for the state of Minnesota to bring to hearings. We incur thousands of dollars of state expense to have a meeting each week to come to this meeting and get our members here. And that's important that we do that, but it's unnecessary to meet in multiple weeks. And I don't think it's fair for the folks that have jobs outside of this place to now have to adjust their schedule or feel guilty. So, Madam Chair, I'm not going to ask for a vote and do that, but I am going to say please reconsider scheduling those again to save the state the money. You could have a future hearing that may come up important. Evidently, your budget is a lot bigger than mine was because you've been able to have a lot more meetings than we would have ever been able to afford. So your speaker gave you a lot larger state budget for your committee than I had, and I prided myself in not spending all my money. So, Madam Chair, I hope you'll reconsider the dates of that for two reasons, to save the money and for the public to really get a chance and for members to participate. We have other committee members on different committees, ways and means or whatever, that may be interested in the PolyMet issue, and they're probably going to be here at the Capitol that week. And I think, I hope you'll reconsider.
Well, thank you for the comment. I will tell you that as we are budgeting, we will come in under budget. But it has been my policy to spend our committee dollars not on travel and things like that that have been the traditional use of committee budgets, but on hearings where the public can participate. So that is perhaps a different policy than some other committee chairs, but that has been mine. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the summary of committee budgets is available, and maybe that's something that you can get and compare that to prior years. That's the Rules Committee adopted these budgets, and I don't think there's anything extraordinary about the budget for this committee.
No, I don't think there's anything extraordinary about it, except for my general rule that we do not spend it on travel and conferences. We are spending it where the public can participate. So that would be, that is my general rule.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I didn't clarify, and maybe I wasn't clear enough to you and to Representative Hansen. The meeting scheduled for the week of February 11th and 12th will cost the state of Minnesota thousands of dollars in travel expense to bring the likes of Representative Erickson, if he wants to come, Representative Fabian, Representative Keel, Representative Falk, Representative Hamilton, have to travel thousands of cumulative miles to get here, and it costs the state thousands of dollars for them to come. They're already going to be here, and they don't get reimbursed multiple times in a single week. Rural members get paid once a week to come in here, and if they're already here, we can save thousands of dollars. So, no, you are paying for travel that you don't need to pay for to bring people in for a week that they're already going to be here, a different week that we were told by your speaker to plan on being here so we could have time for our family the other weeks right before session. So I'm not sure why you're not coming in with the week that the speaker asked us to set aside on the regular committee times when we could save thousands of dollars of travel money. And I don't like the illusion that maybe I was the one that spent a bunch of money on travel, because we didn't have any interim committee meetings that I didn't need to worry about only having about three people show up for.
More than three people here today.
Representative Fabian, would you like to say something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Representative McNamara's point, speaking for myself and not any other committee members, I too would encourage you to consider having those meetings during the scheduled time. I obviously have a great deal of distance to travel, and you know that I'm interested in this community, and I appreciate the fact that you're having the hearings. I think they're appropriate and worthwhile. I also have an interest in the PolyMet stuff that's going to be going on down here that week. It would be easy for me to combine all those into one. I've got another committee that I'm on that's having meetings that week, and it would just be nice to be able to combine those. Thank you.
We are having a meeting on the 28th, I believe that is in that week. We are having a meeting that week. If we have another meeting that week, it will be on another topic, because I have a whole list of other topics that folks are pressing me to have hearings on. So I will take that under consideration. I will definitely take that part under consideration. I will want to thank our page for today, Lynn Sanbo, and wherever. Thank you very much. And with that, members, I look forward to seeing you on the 28th, 8:15 in the morning.